Hello, and thanks for finding My Cape York Life, a podcast about the people who live on and care for Cape York.
And here I'm sitting down talking to Lindell, and now the biggest croc is on the shore and they're lying down.
So this is a pretty special interview, this one, I think, to have that croc appearing over there.
Yes, when you want to do interviews, it's best to go out on country because you can see things and you know what we're talking about.
I can't begin to imagine the connection that traditional owners have with country, but I certainly get a feeling as I hit that area. Mm. Something akin to it, I think. Worries fall away and feel lighter and different. And I love working to protect this amazing place because it deserves it.
Here where we are now, we are about an hour and a half drive from Cook Dam. Sort of in the middle of the heart and soul of everybody around us. It's a good place. Love being out here.
I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management. As I travel the Cape, I'm amazed and inspired by the people finding innovative ways to meet the challenges of living here. You'll meet them on My Cape York Life and get to know this beautiful and remote landscape through their eyes and through their experiences. My Cape York Life is brought to you by Cape York Natural Resource Management, with the support of the Australian Government's National Land Care Program. You can find all of our episodes on your favourite podcast app or on our website at landmanager.capeyorknrm.com.au. This time, we're in Woodjil Woodjil, a lovely, small Cape York town set in the rainforest along the Bloomfield River. It's a beautiful location just north of Cape Tribulation and south of Cooktown. Billy Harrigan remembers how hard it was to get here when he was a kid growing up in Woodjil Woodjil. He has worked in many roles across Cape York, and these days he's a cultural officer with the Woodjil Woodjil Aboriginal Shire Council. Billy is a passionate advocate for his community and for culturally appropriate leadership and governance, democracy informed by tradition, the lessons of the past, and a clear vision of a better future.
My name's Bill Harrigan, and I live here in Woodjil. My family are the Walkers, Yugis and Doughboys, Wallaces, the Yeary family, which is my grandmother and grandfather's family. My grandmother and grandfather originally from Dagara, which in our language is Digarba. And as we were kids, we were growing up here. I was born at Bloomfield, which is about 7K north of where Woodjil is at the present time. That's where I was born. But in contact with my family here, I lived here in Woodjil, growing up with the rest of my family and friends here. Then in 1968, I moved to Cooktown when my dad was working in the Endeavour Butchering Company. Then I lived in Cooktown for about 34 years, and I worked up at Cape Flattery for 16 years. That was between 1978 and 1989-90. So I left up there and I came back to Woodjil in 93. That's where I worked for the council since till the present day at the moment.
Can you tell us what it was like growing up as a kid in Woodjil?
Woodjil didn't exist at the time. We had all the family sort of lived down the river. And I grew up at Middle Camp, which is just about 10K north of Woodjil. Woodjil was only established in the around about 65, but people, all family, lived all over on the north and the south side of the river. We lived at the Middle Camp where my dad owned a block there, and we sold that back in 1969, I think it was, and we were only kids. I moved to Cooktown when I was about 12 years old. Mm. And before that, I sort of grew up here in Bloomfield, in the Bloomfield Valley.
You said that Woodjil wasn't established as a, I suppose it's a council area really, isn't it?
It was established by the Lutheran Church. Back in the 50s and 60s, everyone sort of lived down along the river, on both sides of the river, and depend on all different clan groups. We've got three clan groups here, and I lived on at Middle Camp there, which was part of my grandfather's side on the northern river side of the Bloomfield River, and my grandmother's from the southern side of the Bloomfield River.
So what are those clan groups?
We've got three clan groups here. Some of them were brought down from, like, within the Yalanji Nation. We had three clan group here. That's the Gugunjungal mob. That's from Rossville, Black Mountain area. And then you got the Yalanji mob, which is the coastal mob that lived down the beach area, and where the Digarba Wara or the Wujal people now, as that in those days we were the Wujal Wara people, that as we were growing up here. But we were all sort of connected in some ways, yeah. But my grandmother was from the south side of the river, and my grandfather was from the north side of the river, yeah.
So it must have been a pretty great place to live as a kid. And what kinds of things did you do? You would have gone fishing and...
I used to go fishing, and very hard those days. My dad used to work in the timber mill here for Mason, who owned the local mill here at the time, till about 69. Then he left to go to Cooktown to work for the Cooktown Interval Butchering Company. After that, we all sort of... my dad decided to move to Cooktown, which was close for his employment there at the butcher shop. So that's why I stayed there till I sort of grew up to be in my teens, and then I went away down to Brisbane for high school from 69 to 73, then came back, and for employment I went to Cape Flattery. That was my first place of employment, yeah.
So how was it for a kid going to Brisbane to... So was that like a boarding school that you went to? And what was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was pretty good, because the Lutheran Church at the time sent mostly all the kids down south to get their education, and... It was very hard. Like, we used to go down in January and come back in December. It was very hard staying away from your parents for that long. That's how it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Were there other kids down there who were from...
Yeah, there were about... Every year there were other kids that from the community here all went down there, and every year they were sent down there till the late 70s. And most all the kids then... when the government sort of starts stepping in and getting everybody on the plane and that, we used to go down by train, which took 2 days. But as the year progressed and played, they used to fly everyone home then and come home every semester. We had 3 semesters a year back in the late 60s, early 70s, you know.
So your first job was at Cape Flattery. Can you tell people, because people won't know what that is, can you talk a little bit about Cape Flattery and what happens there?
Yeah. Well, I went up there in 1978 as a deckhand on the barges. Cape Flattery, which is north of Hope Vale, about 60 miles north of Cooktown, but it's in the Hope Vale Doggett area. I think it is Doggett, or just a freehold land, what they got up there. It's a silica mine, and I worked up there for about 16 years. Then I left there in 1989-90, and I came back to Cooktown and settled there for a while, then decided to move back here in Bloomfield. Yeah.
So up at Cape Flattery, there's quite a lot of people. It employed quite a lot of local people up there, didn't it?
Yeah, mostly half and half. There were European people employed there, plus 50-50 the other from Hopewell and surround, mostly from Hopewell, because it started a lease up there. And it was, I think in 1985, Mitsubishi took over a 99-year lease on it, yeah.
So after there, you came back here? And what brought you here?
There was a job offered at the time here as a work supervisor for the CDEP, the employment thing here. So I took up that job here in 1993, then I stayed here till now, till today, present day, in 2018.
Yeah. So you've still working, you've worked for council that whole time, so you've got some long service leave up then?
Yeah, I had a few. I had two already in the last couple of years, yeah.
And so during your time that you've been here working for the council, what are the different jobs that you've had? What kind of roles?
I was controlling the council workforce down there through the CDP employment work. We had about 250 when I first started here through the CDP program that started back here in 94, I think it was. Yeah, it went on till about 2000, then the government changed it over to a different organisation now. Mm. And as it stands now, it's my pathway, but I'm working for council now, and got a new role in a job, nearly in my retiring year, so I'm, as a cultural officer, I'm here now. Yeah.
So as a cultural officer, what do you do? What's your role?
As a cultural officer, I sort of work with the council, you know, various spots around here where we traditionally and sacred spots, and work in with the council as directed, whatever job they want, meeting ministers and welcome different departments that come to our community and show them around and give them a bit of rundown on what we got here to offer and show around, and just what the council want us to do, and especially the government department that comes in here, different various government department that comes and seek out for help, and it's like warming ceremonies, and where places in within the council boundary where we set up houses and whatever, and you know, just in conjunction with the council, where to say that if you can't go there or go, you know, it's just part of our cultural way of doing things within our council boundary, and
yeah, so yeah. Kind of like cultural induction for people coming in, and
bit of everything, and it's an experience because some days we have warming ceremonies. If we've got new projects starting within the council, we have to go through all the process and legal side of things, plus culturally. And Mari and I, there's another lady here that her and I share, she does the woman side of things, and me, I do the men side of things, but we both work together. Depend on the culturally sensitive area where it's, you know, concern for the women's side, Mari will do that, and for the men's side, and I'll do the men's side of things, Report back to council, and it's all part of the council restructure of all the workforce around here.
Billy, people who are listening to this today could be from all over Australia, or, you know, they could be from other parts of the world. So just, I guess, the significance of this role and a council that recognises the importance of that role is pretty important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very important now. Like back in our days, everything was just, you know, you go along with the government. If it said you got to do this, that, do it, you know, without any consultation with the TOs and various other groups around here. In some area where we can liaise with other department and government department that comes in here to, you know, give us advice if it's, you know, culturally sensitive or whatever. We're here to, you know, give them the best advice and whatever that concern our community here, plus our three clan groups that we all work together, and like every issue is different to one clan, set of clan groups.
In your lifetime, the changes you must have seen in relation to the value that governments and other organisations have placed on culture and local knowledge, traditional knowledge. Have you seen many changes in that regard?
Oh, yes, we did. When I was growing up, like, it was open slather for everyone. There was tin mining here and timber logging. Like, it was just out there. You didn't have all the restrictions put in place like we got today, and going back to the traditional owners to ask for their advice, you know, instead of, you know, pillaging the place. Now we've got all this new where everyone sort of, the government department's got to listen to the people who live within that area and listen to their concern more now, instead of just coming in and saying, well, you can build here and you can build there if you'd like it or not. But back in our days, the government just came in and said, we're building here or building there or doing this and doing that without consulting the Aboriginal people. But there's a lot of change now. And I think the people here and with the government department now, it's all the sensitivity is starting to be recognised, and everyone can have a say without we're being the yes people all the time. Now we can have our say, and, you know, if you don't agree with things, and if you do agree with things, and I think, you know, it'll come to a the best compromise for everybody.
It must have been emotionally and so many ways in those old days when people would come in and just do whatever. It must have been awful for local people.
Oh, it was. You know, they'd come and sort of pillage the place, fishing, tin mining, and that. I know it, them days you have to get work. Like, my dad worked in the mill here for nearly 12, 14 years. But it was work, you know, the best way you can get money. And some of our other family that lived around the community, was under the mission board, under the protection. At the time, we were lucky to have a free man, except my dad was, and he could have worked outside within staying within the government-run thing at the time under a protected rule sort of thing, where you can and what you can and what you can't do. And my dad was a free man. He sort of proved himself. He went out in the station and worked outside without having missionaries or anything like that. You know, yeah, the protected running the place, you know.
Do you remember much about those systems or the stories that you heard from your dad and from your aunties and uncles?
My dad, when he was young, he was sent out in the station when he was about 5-6 years old, and the protected for the half-caste people, they sort of sent him out and got rid of, couldn't stay with the sort of full blood or whoever he was related to or knew about. Then the mission came in, the Lutheran Church established that, and then my dad, you know, you got to prove yourself to work, and he proved himself he can work outside the mainstream, and he just got out and worked out in the station. And that gave us a bit of a relief, because in the community them days, everyone sort of lived on the ration, and it was fully controlled by the Protectorate of Aboriginal Affairs back then. And I think we were one of the lucky ones that we could have went out and just survived out in the mainstream like any other people in this country, you know? Yeah.
We're talking with Billy Harrigan at Wudjawudjal in the rainforest south of Cooktown, Cape York Peninsula. I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management, the makers of the My Cape York Life podcast. My Cape York Life is supported by the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. You can find previous episodes on your favourite podcast app or Google Cape York Land Manager. And you can find Cape York NRM on Facebook and Twitter. We're hearing from Billy Harrigan, the Cultural Officer at Wudjawudjal Aboriginal Shire Council.
I came back to Wudjawudjal after since 93, and I see a lot of changes back since the 90s, and like every year it changes with government departments and rules and regulation, but I'm glad now that they're starting to understand the people concerned within the community without sort of dictating to people now, and people got their voice to be heard if you're with or against, and I think it's a fair deal for everybody now, and it wasn't sort of kept up a hush-hush where you can... Them days, you do what I can, those sort of business, you know. I tell you what to do, and you do what I got to do, you know, and that's it, you know. Didn't worry about the environment or anything like that. Those days, they had no environments or nothing. If you wanted to go down there, when I was a kid growing up long down at Middle Camp there were people working at the mill, European people, and they used to blast the river with dynamite to get fish and all that sort of thing, you know. It was just the norm, like any days. This is going back in the early 60s, yeah. But things changed then with new regulations, government. But back in those days too, there were hardly any people coming through here. When I was a kid growing up in the Bloomfield Valley, there was hardly any cars coming, only the timber trucks and the freight truck that used to go once a week to Cairns to take plies and all that, and we were flat out seeing a car in this valley for weeks on end. Only the rich people that who had a car or a Land Rover that could afford it, there was hardly any cars growing up in the 60s, and that, you know, it was so free range.
So how did you travel, how did you get around, or you stay put?
Oh, we had boats and that, or if not, just walk, you know, and if you can afford a car, any sort of car that was, you know, it was something that, you know, you've got to be proud of. But them days, everything were very hard growing up in this community. Yeah.
So nowadays, you see quite a lot of people travelling through.
Yeah. Now it's sort of opened up now, and the whole valley now, it's been exposed to everybody, and it's growing, and the whole place with tourism coming through, and, you know, it's just changed a whole lot. Days on end, they never used to have any vehicles or any, you know, people coming through here, just the local people that lived here. Yeah.
And now that you've got lots of tourists coming through, how has that changed the community and all, you know, people driving, I suppose, from Cooktown to Cairns and Cairns to Cooktown?
It's an easy access now. Back in my days, we were flat out going to Cooktown. It was a nine-hour trip sometimes, you know, just to get to Cooktown. You know, it was an everyday event, and stay overnight in Cooktown and drive back on a Sunday. It'll take another 9 hours to get back, but it was an adventure.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have the good road, you didn't have the bitumen, but it was a road, you know.
Can you tell us, like, because I've just driven down on that road now, and it's January, so we've had quite a bit of rain in the last few weeks. So can you just describe to us what the countryside is like around here and the mountains?
Well, we live in a rainforest country here. We're up nearly up at the top end of the rainforest chain from we're at the, say, at the northern end of the wet tropic area. Just sitting on the water about 75k south of Cooktown. Now the tourist is coming through, and you know, it's more open now to the public, and they're sort of utilising the whole road system here. But in the wet, we still have a few ups and downs, but that's normal because, you know, from Woodgill to Cooktown, and we've got a main highway now, it's bitumen all the way, which is good, and it'll take us an hour and 15 minutes or a bit more. Yeah. And the coast road, it opened up, I think it was in 86, and cut short people to travel to Cairns or Cooktown or go around the long road access back to the main highway to go around there, back on the inland road. But now we've got this highway going back down toward Cape Trib, and we're hoping one day we can upgrade it to bitumen standard, then probably progress will expand more on that, yeah.
Just going back for a minute, like you said, in the old days it used to be a nine-hour trip to get up to Cooktown, and it's 75k, so that just paints a bit of a picture for people. It's really quite rugged and...
quite rugged. I remember when I was a kid growing up here, my dad had a Fargo truck, and we used to carry corduroy, which is a log, and use it on the road all the way to Cooktown, and I was... used to ask him, why are we carrying the log? He said, oh, we've got to put it on the creek bed because they've got no base at the bottom of the... It's rock or else we get bogged.
Yeah.
And it was an adventure, just going into Cooktown. It was a nine-hour trip. But it was something that we look forward to. You know, we never used to get out of this valley very often, only when we used to go to school or go to Cooktown for our school sport back in the early 60s. And it was very hard.
What are we now? 2018.
Yeah.
So we... few years under your belt.
Yeah.
You would have seen a lot of change during that time. What are the things that concern you now for the future of kids and, you know, your family growing up here?
The new technology, I think it's good in a way, but sometimes I've got doubts about it because with this internet and all this bullying now, Facebook and all this new technology, it's good to have all that, but it got this... downside of things too, because you know, can cause a lot of family friction and disturbances or whatever. You know, the new technology comes in. I know you can't change it, but you just got to change with time, and that's how we see it every day now. Just a change, it's changing every time with new technology, digital or whatever in this community now. We're, you know, sort of open to the world now, really. Yeah.
How strongly are young people connecting with culture and country?
Very few of them now. They're not few of them are connected. Some of them are still going hunting and doing their thing, but the new technology like Facebook, and you got your phone now and mobiles and that, you know, just the fiddly things what they do these days, that I think that's what sort of occupy their mind more than just going out and doing the hard yakka, I reckon.
Yeah. And what opportunities do you think there are for young people, like particularly those that want to stay in community or ones that want to go away but maybe come back?
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity now. I think all different departments here is offering a lot of scholarship and doing things now just to get our kids up to the standard, like out in the mainstream. But it's up to the family to push, you know, sort of push it. And few like to go out and, you know, experience life out in the mainstream, and some of them will just... you know, we'll just hang around here and stay here, and you can't stop progress. But some of the kids that get into this new technology, it just I don't know, just some of them are just so glued onto it, and, you know, it's very hard to get them out of that habit.
Hard to get them outdoors.
Outdoors, and it's just the new technology is sort of brainwashing everyone, I think it is, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder how we can embrace that new technology and come up with some good ways.
Well, I don't know, I can't see the future, because some of the kids I see now has either got their heads down and just doing all this stuff, and...
Yeah.
I don't know what lies going to lie for them. It's easier for them now, you know, going back nearly 50 years ago where we were kids, but today the new technology, I think it's driving them more down a path where they sort of, I don't know, some of them are educated to go on, and some will start go down the other way, you know what I mean? It's just,
yeah.
A few of them might take up the challenge, go to uni or do whatever they want, but some of them will just want to stay around here or... Mm. Just go with the new technology and just to suit their own thing, you know what I mean? It's just very hard.
Mm. And, Billy, you're not far off retirement before, you said.
Yeah, about a couple of years I hope to be retiring. And
so what does retirement hold for you?
Oh, just go out and do my normal stuff like I was a young kid again, fishing, and just go on the land. I'm hoping to go back out to Normanby, out to the station where my father's homeland. Just pass the time away there and just do what I've got to do every day. Yeah.
So we've also spoke with Vince, who's your nephew in this series, and he's up at Normanby there.
He's working there, I think, for Mulgan Water Rangers. Yeah, he's working for them in conjunction with the Rangers Department there, and... He's taken over from where my father left off and his father that died a couple of years ago, and he's running the station out there now. So,
and how important is that for you to know that you've got these young people coming through and continuing some of that work?
Yeah. No, I think it's good now with, you know, the new technology that's coming in. There's always a challenge somewhere down the track for whatever job you're going to do, and it's more open now as we got our land back, and that's from my father's side, and you can go out there and plan whatever you got to do for the station, run it as a station, or whatever you got to do, right? You know, keeping everything intact out there, and just running it as a station, and hope to improve on it, as my young nephew's doing out there now, fencing and renovations and whatever out there, roadworks, and hope it. One day we can set out a business out there, enterprise one day, and I think it's a rosy future in the next 10 years or so. Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully kids like Vince's kids will end up out there too. And
yeah, they'll all go out there, because at the moment he's taking the kids out there now and, you know, showing them the culture and how he grew up and how my dad taught us out there what to do. You've got to be independent, go out there, and, you know, you've got to work the land, you've got to make utilise it and care for it, as he predicted. He said, just pass on the generation. He passed on the generation down to all the sons and daughters, and now to the grandkids. Yeah.
And what was it like for you? Like, because you'd have pretty strong memories of that time when that property got handed back. So what was that like for you? How did it feel for you and for your dad and for your uncle?
Oh, he was so excited. He said, oh, the first time when it was handed back, and he said, oh, after all these years, when him growing up out there, and his mum used to walk the same track there, and, you know, he was so delighted and excited and sad, you know, to see that, how it was and how he was growing up in that station. Mm. And as the year go by, and as he got older, and he said, oh, I wish it was back in my teenage days, or, you know, to be out there with his parents out there. It was very hard, but when the station was handed back, and he was so excited about it, you know, thought it would never happen in his lifetime.
Yeah, it's pretty special.
Yeah, very special place for him. As he grew up in that area, he knew where all the arts were, and caves where the painting and everything was out there. He knew exactly in his childhood days, and now he's passing that on to Vincent and all that. Yeah,
all that knowledge that you know, it's passed through thousands of years, yep. and to be have that gap in time where people didn't have that connection.
No, it didn't, because he was sent away to a station when he was a kid, back in those protector days, back in years going back from the 50s, right back to 1900 and all that. When they were sent away, they were all sort of fingerprinted, and all the kids that was out in that area, they were sent away, and the half-caste ones were rounded up and sent out under a cattle station and named after whoever boss at the time. That's how everyone got their name, yeah. Mm. When he first went back out there, he was so happy to see, you know, just thinking about how he grew up in that area and being away from that place for nearly over, you know, 50, 60 years. Like, he never sort of got... He was 84 then when the place was handed back. And, you know, so many years when growing up as a kid and being sent away and never been back there for a long time. And, you know, I think it was... It sort of gobsmacked him, you know, just to say, oh, I'm back here now. And, you know, it was a hard road, but it was a challenge for him, and he was very excited. Mm.
Thank you. Have you got anything else that you'd like to share with us today? Any stories?
On my mother, grandmother and grandfather's side, my mother's mum and dad, it was very hard for them in those days. You know, how I see it now, it changed so much with, you know, as the year went on, when I came back here after I moved to Cooktown and all that, what I just told you, coming back here to see how this place expanded and starting to grow, and I felt sort of good in a way, and I felt sad, you know, just for the family that was growing up here back in the early 30s, 40s, 50s, and that's gone back when my grandmother and grandfather lived in this area. They lived a very hard life, but I'm thankful for them and to where I am here today. And through them, I wouldn't be here, you know what I mean? But I'd like to pay my respect to them for what they went through. It probably would have been a harder life for them compared to my life. It's so heartbroken, but we've just got to move on, you know what I mean? But it's something that I'll cherish all the time, and someday I'll sit at home and, you know, think about is how my other relations, my grandmother and grandparents here, grew up, and it was very hard for them. It was when I was a little boy, and I can see, you know, they went out, just seeing them just to survive every day and just to put food on the table for us. It wasn't like today now. It was very hard. The store was only open once a week, and it's not like you can just go down the road and get everything. It was, you make do with what you got, and that's it. You couldn't be fussy about anything. Yeah.
It's a much harder life.
It was a very hard life, yeah. But I think, you know, as the time go by, and, you know, you can reminisce on all the past, but it's always there in the back of your mind, and, you know, although you can be very grateful and be thankful to your family in the past that, you know, to be here in both my mother's side of the family and my father's side of the family, I think it pays where you know, you can just feel sad about it, but you're happy about it, but, you know, it's still a mixed emotion, but I'm happy I'm here today. Yeah.
And your hopes for the future?
Well, I hope to, when I finish working here, I'll go back to Cooktown, then probably go at the station and just retire there, and probably stick me out in the long yard somewhere out there and have a good and have a fruitful retirement, I suppose, you know, but still be doing things, what, you know, to survive.
Yeah. Thank you. That sounds like a pretty good way to retire and to get back out in that beautiful country up there as well. Because Woodjall's certainly a gorgeous place to be living.
And I'm very thankful for, you know, both sides of the family. You've got the rainforest side from my mum's side, and I've got the open savannah country on the north side, west of Cooktown, and they're two different country, you know. But you can't put one over the other. Both is good in my eye, you know.
Yeah.
As I see it, you're in a rainforest country where you can cherish it from your mum's side, then you can go out in the open plain country where my dad, you can cherish that too as well, because they got beauty and they got different beauty in different spots, but it's still in my mind where you can appreciate both. Yeah.
Billy, I'm very thankful that I've been able to spend this time with you today. So thank you so much for talking to us.
No worry. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Billy Harrigan, the Cultural Officer at Woodjawoodjal Aboriginal Shire Council. Next time on My Cape York Life, Waratah Nichols, artist, teacher, community dynamo, who came for a visit and decided to stay on Cape York Peninsula.
I live at Mungumbi Valley, which is at Helenvale. Most people would know where the Lion's Den pub is. So if you actually stand at the Lion's Den pub and look across the road and take a leap of a couple of kilometres, you'll end up in my backyard. The Mungumbi River or creek runs through the property, and I have a little area that I've cleared, which I've planted fruit trees and built a house there. And that's my little private piece of paradise. But I seem to spend a lot of time travelling around Cape York and going into communities, doing community art projects and environmental arts projects.
My Cape York Life is a podcast made by Cape York Natural Resource Management with support from the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. Whoa, it's a damn big island. Look for previous episodes at our website, or search My Cape York Life on your favourite podcast app. And you can find Cape York Natural Resource Management on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Lyndall Scoble, and I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life. I tell you, Molly.